We're looking at the double miracle or intertwined miracle that involves the healing of Jairus' daughter, and second, that involves the healing of the woman that touched the tassel of Jesus' garment. And we started out with the fact that we could sort of outline, beginning in chapter 8, verse 49 and 50, the fact that they contain two separate and distinct messages. One of futility, and that is verse 49, just to pick up our context. While he, Jesus, was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." And we simply call that a message of futility. She's dead. Nothing can be done about it. She is permanently dead. Don't bother Jesus. Factor him out of the picture. Jesus comes along with a definite message of hope, and that is in verse 50, and that's where we start tonight. So, notice several things. When you compare the message of verse 49 and the words of Jesus in verse 50, notice that Jesus completely disregards the message of doom. He completely disregards the first message. He does not comment upon it. He does not rebuke it. He does not correct it. He does not say anything about it. He simply, one word gets it. He disregards everything that the man said. And that points to something that comes through in all of the gospel accounts, and that is the composure of Jesus. And you ought to always read the composure, the dignity, the imperturbability of Jesus. He is always composed. And when this message says nothing is going to happen, she's dead and it's hopeless, he does not come back with a correction. It's just as though the message was not even spoken. I like to think of it in terms of remembering once seeing a large, what are those really big dogs? Not St. Bernard, Great Dane. A Great Dane and a little, what's a real little dog? Chihuahua, for sake of it. And watching the little Chihuahua just was barking and nipping and making all kinds of noises at the heels of the Great Dane. And the Great Dane was just as unperturbed, just as though the little thing, you know, flick him off. And you kind of get this type of thing is that here's Jesus, just completely composed, completely together in this context. The second thing we know from the grammar here is we know Jairus was afraid. And the text definitely tells us that because you come down to the words of verse 50. Jesus heard this and he answered him, speaking to Jairus, "Do not be afraid any longer." Remember last week we did a little work with some of the ways the Greek Testament is put together. And one of them is it can say, "I command that you don't begin to do something." Another is, "I command that you stop it." And the construction here in the Greek New Testament, which is a may plus a present indicative, forbids something from happening. So we could translate, "Stop being afraid." And the "stop being afraid" means that the man was. And Jesus senses it, and he sees it. And he says, "Stop it. Put it to an end." So we know from that he was very much afraid in this context. Now, question. How can one make fear go away? He has commanded that he stop fearing. How is he going to do it? I remember many years ago in college, in a class in psychology, the teacher came in and he put up a large poster, must have been 3 foot by 3 foot, and it had painted on it a very orange. And he said, "Now look at the orange. Now, close your eyes and try to forget it." And what happened, the more you concentrate on forgetting the orange, the bigger it gets, the more vivid it gets. Sometimes when you concentrate and someone says, "Don't be afraid," the more you try not to be afraid, the more you are. And the antidote to fear then is the word believe. Fear is not conquered directly. Fear is conquered through faith. So how can one make a fear leave? And the answer is by believing. Make fear go away. How do you do that? You do that by believing. But believing also implies you got to add something to that. Believing what? Believing that everything will go for the better? Well, in the context, there were three things that Jairus came to believe and needed to believe. Number one, he needed to focus on the presence of the Lord. The very fact that he was there, presence was important. He also, in verse 50, was told, "She shall be made whole." So he has to believe in the presence of the Lord, and he has to rest on the promise of the Lord. But even if the Lord is present and he promises to do something, there's still a third element that's got to be in the picture, and that is he has to have a sense of the power of the Lord. In other words, being there present and promising to help is one thing, and that's good, but can he perform? And so the performance has to be there, and therefore he seems to say, stop being afraid. How do you do that? You do that by believing. What do you need to believe? Well, you need to believe that I'm here, I'm present. You need to believe what I've said to you, that she'll be made well, and you need to believe that I can perform that which I promised, or that I can do it. And he responded there. Now, when we come down to the word, only believe. Last Sunday, we talked about the seven tenses in Greek. Only believe. What do you think tense that might be in? If we come down to verse 50, stop being afraid, present tense, stop going on being afraid. And then he shifts tense and says only and changes to an aorist, which is an act. So the idea is this. Stop the ongoing fear. Stop the ongoing fear and make a definite act, aorist tense, make a definite act of faith. In other words, you got a new difficulty. Before you believe me that I could heal her, now I want you to believe that I can raise her from the dead. She was sick and you believed. Now go on and continue and let your faith go on. That moves us then to the second part, or the scene of confusion. Now before we come to it, let me give you something to think about as we look at 51 through 53. Was she dead? We've gone on assuming she was, haven't we? How then, if she is dead, do we interpret the verse that comes down, verse 52, when they were all weeping and lamenting for her, he said, Jesus said, stop weeping, for she has not died. She's asleep. Now what does that mean? Does that mean she's in a trance? Or do you think she actually died? And I only drop that in your mind right now. I think there's a clear-cut answer in the context. But what I'm trying to make a point of is this. Never assume in Bible study. I have been talking about the raising of his daughter, and I have been presenting you an assumption that she was dead. I think that's right. But good listening habits to Bible study would say, now wait a minute. You said she was dead? How do you explain then the words, she has not died, that Jesus spoke down in verse 52. So that question ought to be in your mind, and it's all part of the careful, critical question, asking, filtering out what the teacher says to be sure that you're really getting the truth. But before we get there, notice what happens. Three things. Number one, in this context, Jesus makes a selection of witnesses. Who is going to get to hear and see? And so verse 51 focuses about that. Now, while it is true that all of the disciples were witnesses to what Jesus did and said, when we come, for example, to the book of Acts and they're going to replace Matthias, they say we've got to have somebody who from day one has heard what Jesus said, seen his work, and are first-hand witness. And that is a primary requirement for an apostle. An apostle heard, touched, saw, lived with Jesus, saw the raising of Lazarus, and observed all of that. However, in the circle of witnesses. In the circle of witnesses. And while many people saw also, I'll put parenthetically, your basic witnesses to the life and the teaching of Jesus, which would be the apostles. So within the circle of witnesses was a select circle. I forget what, I think it's one of the Clement of Alexandria, refers to Peter and John, Peter, James, and John, and says they were the elect within the elect. They was the selected within the select, because they were called out to be a very special witness. And the select circle was made up of three. Now, to see who they were, you might call them the select circle, or you might say these were the most intimate witnesses. Peter, James, and John. They were the ones from which the Lord would call out on occasions and say, I want you three. The rest of you wait over here. I want you three to come with me. And so notice the occurrences. This is one of them. Verse 51. When he had come to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter, John, and James, and the girl's father and mother. So notice, from among the 12 disciples, 9 were left outside, and 3 were taken in. So just to see this thing occurring, first you had a select circle called out from the rest of them here in Luke and parallel passages, Luke 8:52. Or is it 51? 51. And it's the raising of the girl. Now you could perhaps say, well, that was just a special occasion, but it wasn't. Because if you look over to Matthew chapter 17, he did it again. Matthew 17. It's another case where he calls out his select witnesses. And here, the event is the transfiguration. And 9 of the disciples were left out, and 3 of them got to see it, or got to go with Jesus to the mount. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. So notice the select place that they had. Third instance of separating them out is in Matthew 26:36. Matthew 26:36. And the words of the text are as follows. Then Jesus came to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And he took with him, select circle, Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, that would be Peter and John, and began to be grieved and distressed. So you see, there is a pattern that these men are picked out on special occasion to accompany Jesus to see things that the others did not see. Matthew 26:36-37, and the event is Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane. Now, is it fair to say, and don't you want to ask this? Does anyone want to ask a question? Why? Why Peter? Why James? Why John? We've got the fact. So, our second point is, why these? My answer is, I don't know, but I'm going to say so anyway. And I'll just say this, when I put they're just suggestions. Why were these men special? First of all, why do you think Peter might have been called out? The whole foundation of the church, Matthew 16, is based on what? Peter's confession. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And the Lord replies back that flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, Peter, but it is the foundation on which the church rests. Could it not? And in all the apostle lists, by the way, who is always first? Always Peter. In all the apostle lists, Peter is always first. So he has a place of primacy in the lists in the New Testament, and his foundation is important. So perhaps he's included because he is prime in the sense that his confession of the Messiahship of Jesus becomes the foundation on which the church rests. His confession was and is foundational. And if you wish to look at that, it is Matthew chapter 16, down about verse 16, 17, and 18. So it's easy to see, because of the special place, why Peter might have been called. Why John? And the answer to that is very simple. John was just special. And we have mentioned in his gospel, and I'll list them for you, John 13, 23, 19, 26, 20 and verse 2, 21 and verse 7, and 21 and verse 20. And in those verses, you have the statement as to why John was special. And what is it? It doesn't say really why, it just establishes he is that he is identified as the disciple that Jesus loved. So it's easy to understand his place in the list is that he was simply a favorite of the Lord, not meaning that the others were loved necessarily less, but John was very special. But what about James? Anyone know anything that makes James special among the apostles? Look at Acts 12. And Acts 12 certainly gives a good reason why this man is quite special to the Lord and in reference to the witness for Christ. Acts 12, verse 1. About that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. So we do know then from Acts chapter 12 and verse 2 that he was from the apostles the first apostle to die for Christ. Now, I did not say these were the reasons. I simply say that these, to me, suggest the special place that these three men had in the ministry of Jesus and why they were picked could well be explained by their by the place that they played in regard to the ministry of Jesus. Okay, the selection of witnesses, verse 51. And now, number 2, the words of Jesus. The words of Jesus. 8:52. Verse 52 of Luke reads as follows. Now they were all weeping and lamenting for her. When we read about weeping and lamenting, we need to get it in the Oriental culture. This doesn't mean that they were sitting around the casket or the body and they were dabbing at their eyes with Kleenex or handkerchief. This was noisy. It was loud. It involved professionals that came in to make noise. And the mourner was a professional. He came in, he wailed, he made noise, they played flutes. The other accounts show this, and there was all kinds of dissonance and wailing, and that was a sign of respect for her. So this is a scene of commotion that we're coming into. They were all weeping and lamenting. There was noise. And he said, stop weeping. And he does so, I take it, for two reasons. Stop. And here is why. Stop your weeping. For two reasons. One is found in verse 53. As quickly as they were weeping, they turned into what? Verse 53. they became laughing. Why could they go from weeping to laughing? Because they were pros. They were there to make noise. They were there to lament, and it wasn't sincere. So the Lord says, stop weeping, reason one, because it is insincere, as verse 53 would indicate. But more than that, because it's unnecessary. No, it's inappropriate. And what is going to happen in just a moment with this girl is going to show how inappropriate it really is. Insincere, and second, inappropriate. Now, the words found that are spoken by Jesus in verse 52, stop weeping, and stop at that point, from the words, for she has not died but is asleep, are found in all three accounts. So beginning with four, and extending through asleep, those words are common to all three accounts. Common to Matthew, uses them, Mark uses them, and Luke uses them. So all three of the synoptic gospel writers agree together that in our account of what happened, we want to be sure to underscore the fact that the words were identical in each case, and we quote, she has not died, but she is asleep. So this then leads us to a question. Was she dead or in a trance, a coma? Trance has connotations we don't need. Was she dead or was she in a coma? And that question needs to be addressed, and we need to get an answer to that. If trance, then since they thought she was dead, then this would be a miracle of knowledge, if we take it that way. Everybody else thought she was dead, but they were wrong. She was in a trance and or coma, and Jesus knew that. So if that's the case, we still have a miracle, but it's a miracle of knowledge. Everyone thought she's dead. The Lord said she's not dead. She is in a coma. If, however, she is dead, truly dead, then we have a miracle of power. Not that there wasn't power in the first, but power would be the focal point if that is the case. So, which way are we going to go? I am going to go with she was dead. And here are the reasons for that. Reason A, why was she dead? I think the following supports it. Number one, this is not too weighty, but it is there. The opinion of the onlookers that were the opinion of witnesses. Put it that way. They were witnesses. The opinion of witnesses. And what was their opinion? Look down at verse 53. They were not sympathetic, but they began laughing at him. And why were they laughing? Knowing that she had died. And in normal circumstances, if you had been around where a person was dying, and there was a large group of you, and they died, would you know it? Very, very possibly so. They could have known it from perhaps various reasons, but at any rate, their opinion was she's dead, and they so were convinced that she was dead that to suggest anything else was laughable, and they laughed at Jesus. Second evidence, and I think this all by itself, or in our outline B evidence, is the return of her spirit shows that body and soul, or body and spirit, has been separated. What is the essence of death? The essence of the death is separation, isn't it? And the spirit departs. When Jesus died on the cross, he committed his spirit to his Father, and what happened? He died. The body was there, but he was dead because the spirit was gone. And I think verse 55, if nothing else, argues this girl had died. Because it says, her spirit returned. and she arose immediately. So I think that argues very strongly for the fact she was dead. Now, the rabbis would argue, because the Jewish interpretation of death both then, or at least in those times, was when a person dies, the spirit resides for how long? Do you want to remember? Got it. 3 days is minimum. It sort of hangs around and doesn't go immediately. But we must remember that's the interpretation of the rabbis, and the rabbis don't always interpret the scriptures or truth accurately. But you could argue that point, though I think it carries no weight, is that for the spirit to depart in the Bible is for a person to be dead. So that's a second argument. Third, you say, well, how do you explain the fact that he said she's not dead but asleep? And the third, designating a truly dead person as asleep is often done. And where are we going to go for that? John chapter 11. John chapter 11. And we're going to show that one who is said by Jesus to be asleep was also said by Jesus to be dead. So 11:11. Jesus said, and after he had said that to them, this he said, and after he said it to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. That's verse 11. But look at the same words down in verse 14. Then Jesus therefore said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So he who was called asleep in verse 11 is flatly called dead in verse 14. So I think when you put those three things together, the witnesses were absolutely convinced that we have a corpse here. Her spirit returned when the Lord raised her. And it is true, and we can establish, that Jesus himself designated a truly dead person, i.e. Lazarus, as asleep. And that is a phenomena there. So I think we're safe to take, going back to Luke 8, that the girl was, in every sense of the word, dead. We still got a problem, though, don't we? And what's the problem? The problem is still, she has not died. So while I take it that means, what then is Jesus meaning when he says she has not died? And I'll put down several statements that I think would help. Jesus is saying death is not the end of the chapter. Death will not have its final say. He is saying in the end, perspective of the end, life will triumph, death will not. Or, just like sleep is followed by awakening, so this child will wake, that is, live again. And I think that gives sense to the meaning of what the Lord says. To that, you now have the scene of confusion, selection of witnesses, the words of Jesus, number two, and now number three, the ridicule of the crowd. That's verse 53. Now we may point out with verse 53, they began laughing at him. All three accounts record this. He began laughing at him. And I think it is interesting what the Lord does with ridicule. The Lord closes the front door and the back door on ridicule. I would have been tempted, wouldn't you? You guys are laughing. Okay, come on in. He didn't respond that way. He simply closed the door and said, I'm on the inside, you're out. When he went out the door, he closed it also. Because notice down in verse 56, he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. So how does the Lord treat ridicule? He says, I'm not going to give your ridicule any evidence. You can stay outside. And when these people go out, I'm not going to ask them to give you any evidence whatsoever because you're ridicule. Remember way back in the distant past when we studied the book of Proverbs, we developed different characters. And one of them we developed was the scorner. And I remember saying at the time with the scorner, one of the characteristics is he's incurable. The scorner in Proverbs is never cured. And if the scorner of Proverbs is here, and he certainly was, then the Lord makes no attempt to do anything. If you're going to ridicule, I'll not give you evidence. And if you're going to make fun, I will not have anybody come to you and say, I saw it. Evidence is denied the scorner. Evidence is denied the scorner. Not the ignorant. Many times not even the unbeliever, but the scorner. The one who makes fun of and ridicules truth. Jesus put that forth once in an interesting metaphor. To put truth in front of those who ridicule and scorn is called casting your pearls before swine. Same concept is there, and Jesus lives it out in this particular context. Okay, see the third part, restoration to life. Uh, 54 through 56. And notice there are two actions on the part of Jesus. He does two things. Number one, he took her hand. Having done funerals for 31 years, I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people come past the casket. And on many occasions, they will reach in, if it's an intimate association, and they reach in and they will touch their hand. What is that saying? That's saying, so long. Jesus touches the hand and that says, good morning. And I'll show what the good morning is. I mean that in a very literal sense of the word. In all other cases then, the action of taking the hand as Jesus does in verse 50, he, however, took her hand, would be a sign of farewell, and this is leading her back to life. And called, saying, child, arise. There's another little evidence. I didn't really catch it until this moment. Was she in a coma? Or was she dead? He doesn't say, child, awaken. He says, child, arise, agero, and that's a normal word for a resurrection. So he took her by the hand, and he said, and we're going to build on this, rise. And I'll put parenthetically, not wake up. He doesn't treat her as in a coma. So he calls and says, daughter, arise. Now, when Mark records this scene, and let's go to Mark 5:40 because he's got a touch that we need to add that's beautiful. Mark 5 and verse 40. Now try to get yourself in with mom and dad, because mom and dad are here. And they've known her for 12 years. They've known her needs. They've supplied her needs. They have all the memories of her childhood. And they're standing here and they can identify with lots of things that had happened in the past. And when Jesus says what Mark says he says, mom is going to nudge down, and say, that's the way I got her up for school. Many, many mornings. And I'll show you what the words are. 5:40. They began laughing at him, putting them all out. He took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kum. And that is Aramaic for, again, I say to you, arise. But did some stirring around, and I really didn't discover that till this afternoon, and found in some Aramaic literature that in two places where in the morning, it's a narrative of a household, in the morning, it's time for school, it's time for the person, the daughter, to get up, and we have these very words. The mother goes in and says, Talitha kum. That means, out of bed, leave the rack, get up. If that were the case, the Lord reaches over to this child that is dead and says, Talitha kum. If you're a mother and you'd said that to your daughter, wouldn't everything come back to your mind? I would go in so many mornings and say, Talitha kum, and she would bound out of bed. Well, 12 years old, maybe beginning not to bound out of bed so quick, but so many mornings I went in and said, Talitha kum, and she bounded out of bed, and now she's dead. And the Lord says, good morning, little girl, get up. And she's on her feet. Can you identify with the mom and dad? What they must have felt when the words that they had spoken to get her out of bed are spoken by Jesus, and this time they have power. And they have power not to wake her out of a sleep, but power to bring her back from the dead. So it had to be a dramatic, dramatic scene. And it's sort of like, good morning, little girl, time to get up, and she rises from the dead. You just go through and... But didn't they have a long conversation that evening about what happened today and the impression that would have been made on the part of Jesus? All right, with that, we have the raising of the girl, verse 55. He says that her spirit returned and she rose immediately, and he gave orders for something to be given her to eat. Is it not true that people of enormous ability sometimes are not very practical? I remember a professor in school, Dr. Brokenshire. Dr. Brokenshire was, Albert Einstein was a friend of his, and Charles Brokenshire was a believer. And he was a strange man. All white hair, white beard, same black suit with a gold band. And Einstein said, Brokenshire is the most brilliant man I have ever known. But he was brilliant. He spoke 27 and read 27 languages. If Brokenshire were in the library, you didn't go to the index, you went to Brokenshire. It'd say, it's that book, it's on this page, on this side. Do you want it quoted? And you stand in awe of a man like, but he was odd. Wore the same clothes. He always slept through everything. Eyes shut like this, slept through everything and heard every word. And he was odd. If you've known people of tremendous ability, they're often not practical. You know, they are so involved in their ability that they just don't know that they've got one blue sock and one white sock on, because that doesn't make any difference. Do you know the person I'm talking about? They're oblivious to that. You would think a person could raise a person from the dead might not be very practical. But I think it's interesting in this context, the Lord is intensely practical. He's able to raise a dead girl and say, hey, she needs lunch. So the practicality of Jesus comes out in the particular context along with his enormous power that is there. In raising her, he was powerful. Feeding her, he was practical. And suffice it to say, verse 56, I'll let you do the homework. If you have imagined yourself being the parents, isn't this probably truth by understatement? Her parents were amazed. And he instructs them to tell no one what had happened. We've talked about these passages. Remember, there are several reasons why he would say something like this. Number one, to avoid premature conflict. If the miracles got scattered, there was going to be a conflict with the Jewish authorities, which there ultimately was, but it had to be on time. And then second, the tendency for the people to want to take him and make him king, and he wanted to prevent that. And here, I take it, if they're going to ridicule, don't give the scorner any information. He doesn't need it. Okay, with that then, we're through with the text. Let's do some observations. Or applications, whatever you want to call them. Observations. Number one. faith reveals itself in different forms. Faith reveals itself in different forms or different ways. And here they are. First, Jairus. How did Jairus approach the Lord? I take it from chapter 8 and verse 40 that he didn't introduce himself. He was very courageous. The multitude welcomes Jesus, and behold, there came a man named Jairus, tells who he was. He falls at Jesus' feet and begins to entreat him to come to his house. Jairus came courageously. Came courageously forward. Uninvited, he just comes forward, falls at his feet, but secretly feared. And we know that because Jesus had to tell him down in verse 50, stop fearing. So the man comes on bold, but secretly he's afraid. Now look at the woman. The woman came timidly. She didn't want anyone to know. She came timidly forward. But was secretly strong in faith. And we can establish the last part by going down to verse 48. Jesus said to her, daughter, your faith has made you whole. So that ought to help us relax a little bit in that just because Jairus comes on strong doesn't mean he's strong. And just because she came on weak or timidly doesn't mean she was weak. And so I put parenthetically, this shows the danger of judgment by externals. Danger of judging by externals. And that's the first observation. The second one is just to note the nature of the scene going through here. Note the narrative is full of contrast. The narrative is full of contrast, and I'll simply read those off to you rather than write them. It's full of contrast. For example, the anxiety of the father is parallel to the timidity of the woman. The restlessness of the people contrasts the total composure of Jesus. The sensitivity of Jesus, this is a good contrast, contrasts the surprise of the disciples. She touched him, and he says, who touched me? He was sensitive to the faith behind the touch, and the disciples were surprised with all this crowd. How come you don't know it? Who touched you? We don't understand. They were totally insensitive. He was totally sensitive. Performance of the mourners and contrasting their laughter of unbelief. Third, and just two more. There are times when faith is disappointed. There are times when faith is disappointed. Don't you think the man, when he was encouraged that the Lord's coming this way, he's going with me, we're just about home, he got the news that the girl had died, don't you think he was a little bit let down? Never gone through that. You have confidence that the Lord will do something and you get disappointed. What was the command given when his faith was disappointed? There are times when faith is disappointed and then we are told. We are told what? We're told what he was told. Keep on believing. That's a test, isn't it? We are told, keep on believing. Fourth and final. The Lord's eyes saw in secret. He saw what the woman did not say. And his words helped in secret. He closed everyone out, shut the door, and performed the miracle before three men and the mother and father. His help was in secret. There was a resource there that nobody else on the outside, and he helped. And the Lord saw her faith in something she did in secret. He misses nothing. What verse could well go with that? What is it? Hebrews, all things are naked before him with whom we have to do. Isn't that just about, I might jot that in your notes because it's a good passage. Hebrews 4, I think. Let me give it a shot. Speaking of Christ, 4:13. There is no creature hidden from his sight. He knows the touch of faith. But all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. And this passage here illustrates it, and illustrates it beautifully. We'll pick up Wednesday, Luke chapter 9. Father, once again, we are thankful for your care, for the way you deal with us. You may not deal with us the way we ask, but you deal with us in a way that is best. And therefore, may we submit to your wisdom and your knowledge as our Heavenly Father to guide us, to lead us, and direct us in a path that is best for us. And when faith seems to be disappointed, help us to keep on believing in order to express the greater depths and experience the greater depths of your grace. In Christ's name.